title. Thank you. Good morning, New Covenant. My name is Kevin Hamilton, and if you're new to New Covenant or new to me, we take turns teaching here. And so it's my privilege to be here with you again, and my privilege to be back in worship with you after some time away for our family. It's been really great to get through all these chapters of Genesis. We're nearing the end. Hopefully what I have to say today will be meaningful for you, whether or not you've been with us through that story or whether or not you've been here just for today. We've been looking at Genesis as a story of origins. And today we're looking at chapters 38 and 39. There's a lot in those two chapters, and I'll say a little bit about them both. I'm also just want to try to make some remarks about the story of Joseph more broadly and invite you to think about it in some ways next to the stories we've already heard. I think it's good to recall again that this book came together much later than the stories it contains, of course. And really, by the time this book was compiled from a number of different sources and stories, from what scholars tell us, its audiences had already been living under the law and the covenant for some time, right? So the book itself came together long after the stories of Moses and the stories of the Exodus from Egypt and the gift of the law and the temple and the ways of living that came to Israel all through that. So as we look at Genesis, we keep looking back through that lens, and I think appropriately seeing that law, those patterns of living, those ways of living that enable communion with God reflected in the way Israel is telling itself its origin stories. When Genesis was written, Israel had likely not yet fallen into any of its subsequent captivities. So its formative story was still that captivity in Egypt from which it escaped. And in fact, the story of Joseph, scholars tell us, probably was compiled around the time of Solomon. So during a time when Israel was experiencing some real peak prosperity and security. It's an interesting context for this story. I like to think about parts of Genesis as coming together only for a nation and a people who finally got a minute to think, right? There's just so many decades and so much time of wandering, of wondering when they're going to emerge, when the promises are going to come fulfilled. And under Solomon, and under King David as well, they begin to experience some time of just to reflect back and say, okay, these stories we've been telling each other, let's put them down. Let's see what they tell us about ourselves as well. I like to think about Genesis as a way Israel's not only recording their story for prosperity, but asking questions like, who are we again? What were we up against? What do we continue to be up against? What are we made of? And so I think it's been great to read Genesis not only as a history, an origin story, but as an exploration of identity, meaning, and purpose. And because we as Gentiles were invited into that story by Jesus, that origin, those questions of meaning and purpose are ours as well. It's a privilege. So directly and indirectly over the past year, we've been looking at how these stories affirm the law and the covenant. And really, I think there's two big themes that come up again and again. One is that throughout these stories, God is always seeking us. And that's a piece that we see in the law itself. And two is that throughout these stories, there's again and again an admonition to care for the stranger, to care for the disadvantage. Wherever we try to come up with our own ways of sustaining life, our own ways of getting security, prosperity, we're reminded again that God is seeking us. God upholds us. We don't uphold ourselves. And over again, where we fail to care for the stranger, we fall away from the prosperity that God hopes for us. We fall away from the peace that God hopes for us. So these themes, I think, are all through the law and the covenant, the ways Israel lived out its lives, and I think they keep coming up in these stories, and they come up again. But there's also some ways in which each segment of Genesis helps explore and articulate these themes in different ways, because the people are up against different things. So I want to invite you just briefly here to think a little about the differences between these chapters, not just the individual chapters of the scriptures, but the epochs, the stories. So we were with Abraham and Sarah for a while. And we're looking at those, the promises carried out there, these truths carried out there. And I would argue that really their context for exploring those truths of God were wandering, scarcity, and homelessness. That was really a big part of the story of Abraham and Sarah, was experiencing God's seeking them out, experiencing the command to take care of the stranger in the context of wandering, scarcity, and homelessness. Then we get to the stories of Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Rachel. And I think here, I would say it's an underlying question of that whole first piece there is, does God really follow me into bare life? Bare life being like where things really feel raw, where we really don't know where the next thing's coming. It's really a sort of underlying question that story answers. With the next kind of section of stories, the context there seems to be more about internal discord and family conflict. It's less about God's promises, God's truths explored in the context of scarcity and wandering, but of problems that come up at home. So the underlying question there becomes, does God really promise life here in this mess? It's more of a focus there on what we're up against right here. And now we move into Joseph. We started last week. And I would argue that the right context for looking at this story within is the context of plenty, power, and worldly security. This is a third yet different situation in which to explore the same themes. And therefore, we learn new things about God and about life with God in the context of those themes. And the big question there becomes, way down at the bottom, why is God necessary when life is secure anyway? So I would just invite you to think about these big sections of Genesis in that context. I think it's probably right for us to take particular note of this last piece, this final section of Genesis, because though I'm sure we can relate to both of those pieces and those earlier chapters, we both face times of wandering of various kinds, scarcity and homelessness of various kinds. Certainly we both have questions about how we experience God and the tumult of our homes and work situations. I would say that where we live in America and when we live in America, certainly this last question is going to be relevant to all of us. It's a really appropriate chapter and section of Genesis to be looking at today and now. And probably for Israel at the time under Solomon as well. So I just want to point out a couple things about these chapters here before we get in a little bit more in detail. 38 and 39 do a couple of really nice things transitionally, which is that if the whole section before that was about experiencing God in the context of internal family discord, this chapter that we covered last week with brothers against brother, a kind of story, is a kind of transition out of that. It's sort of showing, okay, we still have some legacies from those family infighting here before we move into Joseph's time in Egypt. Another thing that I think is worth noting about these chapters is that 38 is a bit of a strange break, and we won't look at it in detail today, but it's a bit of a strange break in that we started the Joseph story last week. Then we get this chapter 38 that's not about Joseph at all. It's about one of his other brothers, Judah. And then we go back to the story of Joseph in 39. And I'm going to say more about 39 because we left Joseph off in a kind of cliffhanger there last week. We heard a little more from Elise about what happens to him, and we're going to spend more time with that. But I think it's worth noting that the other important function of this today's passage, 38 and 39, is that 38 establishes the lineage of King David and eventually Jesus, right? So a lot of the questions about Genesis are, where did we come from? Where do our promised ones come from? And so far we've been following kind of bloodlines of the great king, King David, and eventually of Christ. That bloodline does not go through Joseph. It goes through Judah, his brother. So it makes a little bit of sense in that regard for continuity's sake of the text that we get this chapter that kind of breaks away from Joseph for a little bit. But the other thing I want to say a bit more about is that this chapter is really important because before it goes, it takes us into this context of experiencing God in the context of power and security, we get one last nod to this instruction to care for the stranger and care for the disempowered in this story. I want to summarize the story that happens in Genesis 38 here rather than read it, because I want to read more of Genesis 39. But the summation here of 38 is that Judah, one of Joseph's brothers, finds that his oldest son marries a woman named Tamar. that son dies, and by the law of the time Genesis was written, the obligation there was that the next oldest brother should then take Tamar on as a widow and bring her into his family and bear children by her, right? So there's a built-in Levitical law to care for the widow, to care for the woman who otherwise would not have standing because her husband just died. In this case, the second son dies as well. And now it is Judah, the father's continued legal obligation, to say, well, now it's time for my third son. But you know, something's going on here. I'm a little worried that I'm going to lose a third son in this. So I'm going to hold off on that for a little bit. So he begins to shirk his law, shirk what he was bound to do, shirk what the law did to take care of the widow. And Tamar is left hanging, right? So that she is a woman to whom the law has said we need to protect, and now Judah has left behind the law. Tamar takes matters into her own hands. She hears that Judah and presumably his other sons are going up to get the sheep sheared, and she dresses as a prostitute where they're going to be passing by. I think, in a way, I read that as like trying to find some way to make this work and get what's coming to her, even though it's not coming to her the way it's supposed to. She ends up sleeping with Judah instead, and he never even knows it because she's in disguise. Later, it comes out to him that this has happened. In fact, she's pregnant. And we have an interesting kind of really Solomonic moral conundrum here. Because on the one hand, Judah failed to follow through on the legal obligation that he was supposed to and provide her with his third son. On the other hand, she has posed as a prostitute and slept with her father-in-law. One way to read that story is that when Judah chooses not to go by the law, which would have made her crime worse, he instead says, this woman is more righteous than I. He forgoes what the law strictly holds her to and says, no, in fact, I'm going to take her into my household. And he does, and bears children by her. I think what the upshot of the story is that it's saying, yes, you've got the law, you've got the Levitical law, but the overarching theme is protect the disempowered, protect the vulnerable, and Judah is following that. He actually sort of breaks from the letter of the law to do that in a way that's reminiscent somehow of even the way Christ instructs people to read deeper. You know, don't just follow the law, go deeper. Find what's really down in there. And what's down in there is protect the vulnerable. And I think that's a really important last acknowledgement of that overarching theme and commandment before we go into this story of empire. But let's move on into this piece of 39. So we heard a little bit from Elise about this chapter. I'm going to read the parts that she skipped over for the kids. Right? So but it's a story of rise and fall, right? It's a story of suddenly, as you heard, Joseph was a slave, but now all of a sudden he's in charge of the master's house. And at that point is when we just get a few more verses here. I'll just read them. Right after we learn that he's put in charge of everything in the house, we read that Joseph was a strikingly handsome man in the words of the translation of the Message. As time went on, his master's wife became infatuated with Joseph and one day said, sleep with me. He wouldn't do it. He said to his master's wife, look, with me here, my master doesn't give a second thought to anything that goes on. He's put me in charge of everything he owns. He treats me as an equal. The only thing he hasn't turned over to me is you. You're his wife, after all. How would I violate his trust and sin against God? She pestered him day after day, but he stood his ground. He refused to go to bed with her. On one of these days, he came to the house to do his work, and none of the household servants happened to be there. She grabbed him by the cloak, saying, sleep with me. He left his coat in her hand and ran from the house. When she realized that he had left his coat in her hand and run, she called to her house servants, look, this Hebrew shows up, and before you know it, he's trying to seduce us. He tried to make love to me, but I yelled as loud as I could. With all my yelling and screaming, he left his coat beside me, and he ran outside. She kept his coat there until the master came home. She told him the same story. She said, the Hebrew slave, the one you brought to us, came after me and tried to use me for his plaything. When I yelled and screamed, he left his coat with me and ran outside. And then we take it to the rest of the story we heard from Elise, where he's put in prison from that by the master, but then still finds himself with some success and some duties. So again, recall, think about how Abraham and Jacob launched into their stories, and let's remember how Joseph launched into his. Abraham launched into his confrontation with scarcity, with wandering, through a direct encounter with God and a promise from God. And we read all of his stories as him experiencing everything in the world he's experiencing through that lens of saying, okay, I'm going through this, but God made this promise to me. We made a covenant back there. He built an altar. That's what I experienced this through. Jacob had something similar. Jacob experienced all these stories of tumult, of family conflict, through the lens of an initial encounter with God there, the dream at the ladder. And that was the lens we're invited to read all of Jacob's struggles through. And Joseph's story begins as well with an encounter with God. In this case, though, through that dream we heard about last week. And I think in terms of literature, we're asked to really look at everything Joseph experienced through the lens of that first dream he had last week, a dream in which first his family and then all the powers of the world bowed down to him. It's a strange kind of dream to hear about that Renee taught us about. So consider this chapter today in light of that. At first, we can imagine Joseph saying, oh, wait, this dream's starting to come true. I thought things were going bad, but now I'm getting in charge of Potiphar's house, so maybe this is going to be the realization of that dream, of God's promise to me through that dream. Others really begin bowing down to him in the house. And then right away, that power takes him into conflict, because power always does, right? There's always a greater power that gets jealous of your power. And Potiphar's wife, who herself is still in power over Joseph as a slave, wants him to subject to her power. So you've got a glimpse of the rise of realization of a promise, like we got in Abraham at times, but a glimpse of the realization of the dream, and then a fall. That dream doesn't seem to be happening. I think the mention of Joseph's physical beauty is not inconsequential in this, right? Because you can imagine that perhaps even that contributed to his rise to power in the house. I mean, plenty of cultures like to give more power to the people who fulfill their definitions of beauty. And I think there's a nod there almost that you could begin to see that perhaps Joseph started to see the dream fulfilled even in terms that were actually worldly terms. I mean, that doesn't mean God can't work through those, but there's a possible nod there. And regardless of that, in Joseph's entrapment by Potiphar's wife and subsequent imprisonment, we do see a threat to the promise of the dream. Like Abraham would experience threats, Jacob would experience threats, and a lot of the story of Genesis is about what these folks do in the face of the threats to the realization of the promise. And just as before, we'll see an opportunity for God to show God's ways, maybe in contrast to the world's ways by which that dream would have been realized. Joseph's entry into Egypt, his quick rise and fall, will provide a chance to see exactly what kind of power, what kind of bowing down, what kind of sovereignty God's kingdom is really based on. Perhaps we see Joseph's original rise as a sort of test of a certain kind of power. Is that the kind of power that was in the dream? Maybe this is an evaluation of that. Joseph's quick rise again to influence even within the prison perhaps is a nod to the power coming truly from God there. And I think ultimately we're going to see the vision of power, the vision of sovereignty that is truly godly in Joseph's relationship to his own brothers a couple chapters down the road here. But I still think we have enough to go on here in this initial glimpse to say something about what kind of power and sovereignty God wants to see in this world. It's a kind of power whose really only function, whose only destiny, is to be given away and surrendered in the service of others. There simply isn't any other place for power and authority in God's kingdom than power to help others. And I think that's really a vision, I think, starts to become more clear in my imagining of Joseph in the prison than Joseph in charge of the house in certain ways. I think we also saw that, of course, through Judah's treatment of Tamar, who's really, again, said, I'm in the position of power here. By the law, Tamar has committed the greater infraction, but the job of the person in power is to be lenient. The job of the person in power is to give away that power and help others. That is God's vision of power and sovereignty. And just to conclude here, I want to wrap up with this passage from the Book of Wisdom that we I asked Barbara to put on the cover of our bulletin. Now, the Book of Wisdom is an apocryphal book, right? It's not a book that's part of the Bibles we have in the back of the room here, but it is part of the Bible that our Catholic brothers and sisters read, our Eastern Orthodox brothers and sisters read, that our Jewish brothers and sisters read. And it was, the Book of Wisdom was probably written around Solomon's time, around the same time that this book of Genesis was written. And today's lectionary, the passage that our Catholic brothers and sisters are looking at in their worship today, is from the Book of Wisdom. Here's the verse I put on the bulletin here. For your strength is the basis of your saving justice, and your sovereignty over all makes you lenient to all. There's some different relationships to power going on there already than what we're used to, right? Only because you're strong do you have a basis for exercising justice and saving justice. And because you're sovereign, it mandates you to be lenient, or leads to you being lenient. Usually, I don't always associate being lenient with being more powerful. It's a kind of inverse relationship. Oftentimes I associate the more powerful you get, the more firm you've got to be. That's certainly the order of a lot of the world we see around us. The only way to keep power is to exercise it more, right? It's a different, this is a kind of backwards. To be lenient from a place of power by a lot of the economies of this world is a quick route to losing that power. Don't be lenient. You're going to lose your grip, right? That's what we get from a lot of places. But God's vision of power and sovereignty is opposite, and that's what we're seeing already in this passage. You show your strength when people will not believe in your absolute power, and you confound any insolence in those who do know it. But you, controlling your strength, are mild in judgment and govern us with great lenience, for you have only to will and your power is there. By acting thus, you've taught your people that the upright must be kindly to his fellows, and you have given your children the good hope that after sins you will grant repentance. So I think in this last character study we started now of Genesis, of Joseph, we're going to see ever more answers to this question of how are God's promises fulfilled in the context of plenty, of power, of security. And when we live in a position of security, we have some power from that. We take power from that our more precarious brothers and sisters do not have. And I think one of the things I hope we'll meditate on is what to do with that power, and exactly how to be lenient, how to give it away, how to exercise forgiveness to all. And certainly we benefit from that each Sunday when we come to the communion tables, as I'll invite you to do now. I'll just invite you to think about God having the first thing God does with power is to exercise lenience towards us. When we're at the communion tables, we're in the proper relationship to God, and God is in the proper relationship to us. We're manifesting the truth of true power, true sovereignty, and being in a position of accepting forgiveness and accepting leniency. And God is in the appropriate position for God's power of giving leniency. So we'll end there and invite you to the communion tables here to celebrate that truth. Amen.